You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin Vase. I'm the Director of Research at the Center in the U.S. and Europe, and as such, I'm largely responsible for the titles of the panels today, including the sober and low-key title that we picked for this panel, the End of Europe. We thought we said the bloody death of Europe or something, but we were more sober and decided on the end of Europe. Now, obviously, we were being cute, but I think the first two sessions stressed the importance of the current economic and financial difficulties and their impact, including their negative impact on the larger European project. And that is precisely what this afternoon panel is aiming at elucidating, if you will. Why is the Eurozone in crisis? How is this crisis going to be resolved? And what are the implications for the European project as a whole? Well, obviously, the story begins in America in 2007 when the housing bubble busted and the subprime mortgage crisis struck, triggering a worldwide economic downturn. And I guess you know the saying, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. And in this case, Greece, which had been growing at more than 4% annually during the whole decade, caught a very bad cold, especially with the slowing down of tourism and the shipping industry, etc. Greece's woes were largely, of course, of its own makings. It had been running large structural deficits for decades, and obviously this could not go on forever. And so when in late 2009 the new Papandreou government revised its deficit projection from about 6% to between 12 and 13%, markets who until then had been lending basically indiscriminately to all Eurozone countries, Germany and Greece alike, started losing faith in the Greek capacity to repay its debt, all the more so that being part of the Eurozone, it could not devalue its currency, obviously. So what followed, as you know, on the market side was the beginning of a contagion, pretty much like the Aegean crisis 12 or 13 years ago, and fears that other countries like Portugal, Ireland, or even Spain could be next on the list. And on the European government side, a painful and messy process of rescuing Greece, which in particular resulted in the mammoth package of guarantees extended by European governments and the IMF to the tune of about $1 trillion last month in May. So obviously we now have many, many questions on our plate for this afternoon about the future of the Greek economy, about the reform of governance in the Eurozone, about the new role that Germany has come to assume in Europe or its policies being questioned, about the financial situation of the European banking system, and of course the larger question of the implication of the crisis for the European project. And to answer all of these questions, we have a great set of panelists today. And I'll start with Scheherazade Rehman. She's a professor of international finance and business and of international affairs at George Washington University, where she's also the director of the EU Research Center. In a previous life, she served as a foreign exchange and money market trader, and she has advised a number of institutions, including the World Bank and the IMF. I may add that Scheherazade is very brave. She went on the Colbert Report to explain the Greek crisis not once but twice in the past few months to an American audience. I won't repeat all the good jokes that Colbert made, but you can get them online. It's pretty entertaining. Lucas, here on my left, is the president of the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, ELIAMEP, in Athens. He's also a Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration at the University of Athens and a visiting professor at the College of Europe. Since April 2005, Lucas has been a special advisor to José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission. And I should add that also in a past life, in the probably in the previous century, Lucas was a professor for MD, who I'm going to introduce in a second. But I'll follow on in the order that the speakers will talk with Ralph. Ralph Rex is co-president of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, to which he has devoted a large part of his career. He joined the Green Party in 1982 in Germany and has been an elected official for some time and has had important responsibilities within the German Green Party. His work has focused on sustainable development and reshaping the welfare state, migration, the future of European integration, and most importantly, international policy. I should add that as Fiona mentioned in the morning, we organized that day of conference in partnership with the Heinrich Böll Foundation, and a partnership that has really worked really well in the past. Last but not least, Andrew Moravcik. You know, maybe 10 years from now, I'll introduce him saying he's an acclaimed critic of opera, a subject to which he's devoting more and more of his time to the detriment of European affairs. But for now, and for what we're interested in this afternoon, Andy is still Professor of Politics and International Affairs and Director of the European Union Program at Princeton. He's also, I should add, a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings and a prolific author. So let's start. I'll ask the panelists to be very brief, and I'll enforce that rule, unlike the European Growth and Stability Pact. I'll actually enforce this measure. And I'll ask Shehrazad to start probably by asking her to try to set the stage for us. What happened? How did we go? How did we get here? And also, if she could give us an idea of the way forward, and then we'd move to the other speakers. So, Shehrazad, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm an academic, so I can probably say a few things that perhaps some others cannot, and I will. What started as a 2007 U.S. subprime mortgage crisis, as Justin just mentioned, and materialized into a full-blown financial panic in the United States, led to a virtual freezing of the U.S. banking and credit markets. And this spread to the Europeans in 2008-09. And then it looked like this highly infectious crisis was abating itself towards the end of 2009, and the world seemed to pull back from this brink of a financial abyss. And then all of a sudden, in early 2010, Greece erupts. And the Eurozone begins to tumble back towards the edge of the cliff, threatening to drag this market back with it. So what happened? And for this, let me just go back a little bit. In the United States, by 2007, we had incubated a very serious mutation of a new type of financial crisis. This mutation doesn't seem to care which sector the crisis begins in. It simply spreads. The contagion is fueled by irrational fear and panic, and the contagion goes across financial markets, across industries and countries, and into the middle class. This new type of crisis needs fast and dramatic action to combat it, rather than straightforward economic logic, because we are fighting fear. And this fear is lingering in the global financial markets even today. It's palatable. It's real. Every time the morning bell of the U.S. stock market opens, even today, you can smell this fear. And this is in the face that the U.S. economy is actually showing some real signs of getting better in the short and medium term. Okay, so if you look at the beginning of 2010, we are coming off a very serious crisis. There's lingering fear in the markets. Age-old theories and rules are being sorely tested. There doesn't seem to be any safe investments on the horizon. Historical data analysis out the window. Stocks are impossible to predict. And there's financial volatility. And this is coming on the heels with the Greeks fessing up that their previous government had perhaps cooked the books a little bit. And there was a very large government bond coming due in May. So by March, all of this gave way to panic, and the markets fulfilled a self-fulfilling prophecy that the Greeks will not be able to pay back the bond and refinance. And adding fuel to this was what I would say is a lack of leadership in the Eurozone governments. And unfortunately, they botched this up pretty badly. Playing domestic political games while they are facing a pretty serious financial meltdown is regrettable. They learned nothing from the U.S. crisis. And when they released the European $1 trillion package, as Dustin said, this was meant to shock and awe the financial markets. And what it did was in fact, fall flat, because it was 3 months too late. You know, Angela Merkel playing chicken with the financial markets at a time like this, in order to buy time for regional elections. Again, you know, this was somewhat regrettable because it essentially backfired, and it broke the eurozone, I believe, into two halves, the rich, economically sound half and the shaky half. And I'll talk a little bit about this more in a second. The Europeans were well aware they had a debt problem, just like in the United States, but they thought this problem was medium-term, if not long-term. They thought it would hit the U.S. first because our debt is a lot bigger. They never expected it to come so quickly, and they forgot about the rules of a currency union. Let me just pick up on this last point. A currency union like the one they have created had some central assumptions. First of all, it assumed that fiscal deficits would be under control, kept under control by a treaty and by a no bailout clause. And eventually these member countries would economically converge over time. Well, these were very, very huge assumptions. We knew at the beginning letting southern countries into a currency union like this was a very, very risky proposition. There was a lot of political momentum at the birth of the euro, and some of this risk was shoved under the rug. And at the risk of offending anybody on this panel, there were some very genuine issues if Greece was really belonged in this currency union when it joined. A currency union is only as strong as its weakest link. Even a small country is too big to fail in a currency union. It's when you get hit with very serious economic and financial shocks that you can show your economic maturity, your strength, and your credibility in the market. This treaty-defined fiscal limits were proved ineffective and irrelevant to some extent. Ineffective because the fiscal rules, which should have been binding, were ignored. Irrelevant because some of the countries that were running very big deficits easily met the treaty's fiscal targets as long as the bubble economies are growing with inflation. For example, Spain. And the markets paid absolutely no attention to fiscal frailties and rated all the eurozone bonds similarly. So this was something to think about. This was the eurozone's first real crisis, and you can't decouple it from the crisis that started here. So where does Europe go from here? I think I'd like to start off by saying that what they've done up to now is buy a little time for themselves. They have four big choices coming down the road. First, how do they now move forward very fast towards greater integration before the markets attack again? And kicking Greece out or any country leaving the eurozone is a non-starter. No country will survive leaving the eurozone except perhaps for Germany. They will be slaughtered by the markets. The Greeks will be dragged back to the Middle Ages if any of this happened, and everybody's well aware of this. Second, how do you manage economic divergence, which is happening, and we've seen it happen? It's clear the eurozone cannot rely on markets alone. They're going to have to adjust institutionally, and this is a tall order. Third, how are they going to facilitate changes in competitiveness and actually create real growth in the long term? Look, fiscal stability is not going to come back into the southern countries unless growth happens. And growth cannot occur in the short run with these kinds of fiscal austerity programs. We know that. Then they can't devalue their currency to export more to grow. And to make another point, they primarily export to each other. So growth is limited from that venue as well. So to increase competitiveness, they really have to drop prices and lower costs. So that's how they're going to increase competitiveness. Like, well, this is a long-term proposition. The last item here is that how are they going to restructure the excessive debt in the southern countries? I think it's pretty clear that Greece is not going to be able to pay this back if you look down the road. They're going to have to restructure. And the trick is, can the eurozone make itself credibly solvent so that it can withstand a round of public and private debt restructuring? We need to face the fact that the eurozone is no longer a homogeneous bond market, at least in the near future, and this is a reality. Let me just leave you with five quick thoughts. I think that essentially Berlin must face what is now being called its moment of truth, and the consequences of a very Catholic marriage with no annulments to Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. There's no going out of this. There's no going back. Secondly, currently the 800-pound gorilla sitting in this room is not Spain, it's Italy. We are scared to even mention Italy in case the financial markets turn its attention to it. And if that happens, that's a nuclear implosion in Europe. Thirdly, I think there's a lesson here for the U.S. We are all aware that Uncle Sam cannot indefinitely borrow at reasonable rates. It's coming down the road. We thought the Europeans had some time, but the debt problem manifested in the eurozone a decade ahead of schedule. And perhaps there's a lesson here for us to think about. Fourth, The euro exchange rate with the dollar, which hit a four-year low yesterday, and is hovering around 1.2, is actually a very good exchange rate, in my opinion, considering the short-term outlook of the eurozone. And lastly, I believe that the eurozone, for the foreseeable future, can no longer be seen as a single unit. It will be comprised of two groups, one healthy group and one very shaky group. And the balance between the two at any given point in
time... Thanks very much, Sherazad. I'll turn to Lucas now, asking him, as a specialist of Europe, a long-time specialist of Europe and the European political economy, what he makes of all of this, and perhaps also in a second part, as someone living in Athens, what the view beyond what we heard in the media, the clichés, etc., what the view in Athens is.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you also for the kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an opportunity also to take part in this discussion. Of course, we have the biggest crisis we have had in Europe for many years, and this crisis marks the end of a honeymoon period for the euro, a honeymoon period that had lasted for almost a decade. I believe there are three underlying factors in the crisis in the eurozone, and I don't have much to disagree with Scheherazade. The first underlying factor is the rise in sovereign debt, which is partly, not entirely, the result of governments trying to deal with the consequences of the bursting of the bubble. The second has to do with growing imbalances between the north and the south of the eurozone. And the third is the widely held perception, more in Wall Street and the City of London than in the majority of European countries, that the Europeans have neither the instruments nor the political will to deal with the existing economic problem. So you start with a real economic problem, to which markets react in a typical fashion, namely the overreact. Having underestimated risk for many years, and having therefore lent to Greek governments and other governments at rates which were almost identical with rates that the German government was borrowing, now they suddenly become extremely risk-averse. Panic prevails in the markets. Scheherazade explained all that. And therefore markets overreact. But also, markets are certainly not rational. If you believed in the rationality of financial markets, I suppose you can believe in anything. And there is also enough evidence to suggest that there's been also a degree of manipulation of markets and cartel behavior by big operators. It's also, therefore, trying to translate bets into self-fulfilling prophecies. The result of the crisis so far has been a significant devaluation of the euro vis-à-vis the dollar and other currencies. This was not intended, although certainly not unwelcome for most Europeans. I presume that in a world of low growth, if this is going to be indeed the case in the foreseeable future, we're going to see more and more of competitive devaluations between the major currencies of the world, and some of them could be rather nasty. But my advice to you would be, don't bet on the demise of the euro and the European Union because you're likely to lose your money. That's the first point. The second is what next? Now, I will briefly outline two scenarios which are more complementary rather than mutually exclusive. The first scenario starts with starting point is that crisis is the mother of change. And in our particular case, the crisis is likely to provide the major catalyst for further integration of the European Union. This is already happening, and we are likely to see in the foreseeable future more closer and more binding coordination of national fiscal policies. We are going to see more effective financial regulation. There is going to be, hopefully, a more effective crisis management and a lender of last resort capacity, which may translate itself from an ad hoc basis to a more permanent basis. But, and all this is happening despite the fact that there is relatively little appetite in most European countries for further integration, and most notably in an important country of the European Union, such as Germany. So further integration is happening because the stakes are very high. And this is something that many people in the Wall Street and the City of London and others have underestimated, namely how much is at stake for Europeans when it comes to the euro and also the European Union more generally. So my prediction is that the crisis of the eurozone is likely to lead to stronger European economic governance,
but this is going to be more of an intergovernmental nature than what we have experienced so far. And if this materializes, this is going to have an effect on the two groups that coexist in the European Union, namely those who are members of the Eurozone and the others, not to mention divisions inside the Eurozone. Now, the second scenario focuses more on broader economic and social consequences of the crisis and not so much on institutions. Now, there is no doubt that there is need for fiscal stabilization in countries, of course, Greece, but also in countries like Spain, Italy, Ireland, not to mention the UK. But there's a very fine line that divides what is a necessary fiscal stabilization from austerity measures that may create a deadly spiral of recession and debt. And you never know what this line is. You discover it in the process. There is a very serious risk that because of panic in the markets and also because of strong reactions, which are largely understandable in Berlin, governments, especially in southern Europe, are going to adopt extreme forms of austerity measures that are going to lead to deep and prolonged recessions in the European South, with implications for the broader European economy. And if that is the case, it is going to have social consequences. There is anger in the streets in several European countries, and not only Greece. This anger is likely to translate itself, if it is combined with higher unemployment and economic stagnation, it is likely to translate itself into more nasty expressions of nationalism and populism, and this is bound to have a long-term effect on European integration. So having said that, let me now turn to Greece. And Greece has been in the middle of it all for the very simple reason that Greece has the worst combination of three different kinds of deficits. A fiscal deficit, which is on top of a large accumulated debt, a deficit in the current account, and a credibility deficit, which has emerged when people realized that Greek politicians had been rather economical with the truth in the past. Now, all countries, many countries in the Eurozone have fiscal deficits, they have current account deficits. Many of them have engaged in creative accounting, but the Greeks have the worst combination of the three. And Greece has therefore attracted much more publicity than it can actually consume. But the publicity and the attention on the Greek problem cannot be explained only in terms of the nature of the Greek problem itself. Greece has been seen by financial markets and by international analysts also as a precursor of things to come in other parts of the Eurozone. Yeah. And this is a very important issue to put an emphasis on. And Greece has therefore also been seen as a test case of how individual European governments and the European Union as a whole are likely to react to an existing real problem. Now, Greece is faced with a huge challenge of adjustment, which has both a fiscal component and a real economy component. The good news is that you now have a government which is ready to act and has already introduced a number of very concrete measures. And the other piece of good news is that you have an increasing number of people, large parts of Greek society, who have realized that the old party is over, that clientelist politics combined with a kind of an economic development model relying essentially on borrowing has reached its limits. Now, the bad news is that the task facing Greece is simply enormous and that the forces of inertia are still strong. I would agree with Scheherazade that Greece is going to remain in the Eurozone, like all other members of the Eurozone, because the alternative is more than nightmarish. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of the crisis, we have witnessed pretty ugly exchanges between populist media and tabloids in Germany and Greece. And very unpleasant stereotypes came back to the surface. And in those ugly exchanges,
several politicians from both countries took part, politicians that should have known better. But let me conclude by saying that this I do not believe to be an issue that will last for long. It is reversible. And my impression is that in my country, in Greece, the anger of the large majority of Greeks is addressed at representatives of their political class and addressed also at each one of them rather than foreign representatives, Germans or others. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lukas. Ralph, I'm now turning to you. Could you offer your thoughts on the European situation and maybe focus a bit on the German response? Angela Merkel has been criticized by many quarters. Do you think she responded in the right way? And how do you? What's your assessment of the German response so far?
Mm. Well, usually I am not the super patriotic guy. I'm also quite unhappy with the lack of political leadership and especially of European spirit shown by the German government and Chancellor Merkel in person. But having read and having heard so heavy criticism on Germany, especially from U.S. commentators, I felt some relief when I stumbled over headline on the editorial pages of the Financial Times some days ago, "Don't be beastly to the Germans." And, you know, I think Angela Merkel and her government have been guided by two major deliberations. First, they try to limit the amount of financial obligations for German taxpayers, which feel now being taken hostage for the debt of Greece and other potentially illiquid members of the Eurozone. And the second major guideline, to put it in a mild light, they fought for strict conditions and obligations in exchange with credit guarantees to other European countries. And it has always been a nightmare for the German public that monetary integration in Europe may lead to a slippery slope of increasing public debt, fiscal irresponsibility, and inflationist policies. And, you know, having in mind the dramatic turnaround of European economic policies over the last weeks, you can criticize that the German and other European governments have acted too slow, too restrictive, too cautious, too chicken, but at least this was almost a revolutionary move. A huge step for Europe. Please don't forget that two crucial elements of European economic governance and of the European treaties have been thrown out of the window overnight. The first element, and Schelzerade already named it, was the no bailout clause, that there should not be mutual liabilities for other states' debt. And the second core element was that the European Central Bank should not be permitted to cover national budget deficits by lending money to governments. And both principles had been set out of course overnight. And unwillingly, forced by the dynamics of the financial crisis, this was a huge step towards, as Lukas already mentioned, a stronger European monetary and economic governance based on tighter fiscal rules and extended coordination of budget policies. And we are still middle in the way to find a new set of rules, not only for the European Currency Union, but for economic governance within the larger European Union. The huge financial umbrella for endangered European states didn't resolve any problem. That's true. But it bought time to do the real business, and I would like to focus on these real challenges we have to face over the next month and realistically over the next years. First, we need a redesign of the European Stability Pact, including rules for orderly default and restructuring of debt backed by the European Commission and eventually by European Monetary Funds. And as far as I can judge it, there will be no realistic way out of the crisis for Greece without this kind of rescheduling its step. And maybe not only for Greece, but this must be done in a controlled and politically steered and backed way and not in a chaotic process, delivering whole economies and societies to the panic in markets. And the second big challenge, the second real thing will be to develop a consolidation strategy based on both fiscal adjustments. This is what in the moment stands in the foreground. And the second element has to be structural reforms to promote economic growth and improve the competitiveness of the Eurozone as a whole, and especially of the economies in Southern Europe, which had been falling back in terms of productivity, labor costs, and international competitiveness. We have to reduce the imbalances within the Eurozone, otherwise we will not be able to keep a common currency. And looking to the current conditions, obligations, stabilization programs, not only in Greece, all over Europe, there is, of course, a huge danger that they will lead into a deep economic recession, at best in a long-term stagnation. So we have to combine fiscal responsibility, fiscal adjustments, with investments in competitiveness and the innovation capacity of the European economy. And we need to maintain investments in human capital, in education, research, science, and in greening the European economy, which will restore our economic, our industrial basis in a globalist world under the restriction of resource crisis and climate change. And the third big thing will be, and maybe we will not have very long time to do it, the recapitalization of the European bank system, which is undercapitalized and overloaded with critical sovereign bonds. As far as I know, Schitzerade will have the figures maybe more profoundly. Capital of European banks, in average, is about 5% of their assets. In the USA, after the restructuring of the bank system, it's around about 12%. That makes a difference in terms of resilience in critical situations. So I would say I'm quite confident that the European Union and the Eurozone will overcome the current crisis. But on the long term, we are facing really fundamental challenges. The combination of structural imbalances of public budgets, demographic change, which makes an enormous difference between Europe and the United States. We have a declining workforce and a growing part of our society depending from welfare services and welfare payments. And we have for a long time an anemic economic growth. And the combination of these three is really challenging. So muddling through will not be enough, but on the other hand, the European Union always developed over crises, and I hope very much that we will not fail the opportunity this crisis offers to us.
Thanks very much, Ralph. Lastly, Andy, could you specifically address the sort of political implications of the crisis for the larger European project, for the European construction, and maybe the underlying damage, if any, that the crisis is bringing to important European goods like, confidence, a sense of solidarity, etc. And at the end of the day, try to enlighten us on whether it's just a blimp or bump on the road or a major crisis.
Well, there's a tendency in situations like this, crises, to focus on the moment and the headlines and not focus on fundamentals, to sell stock in a panic. And I think if we focus on the fundamentals of Europe, we'll see that Europe's status in the world doesn't change that much as a function of this crisis, and in fact is much better than most analysts think it is with regard to those fundamentals. The conventional wisdom, I think, is that Europe has already declined out of the rank of great powers singly and collectively, and that it's now U.S. and China and India for now and forever. My view is that Europe is the second superpower and will be for a generation or two by almost any measure. And I think there are three reasons to believe this is true. The first is just a look at the basic foundations of global influence and importance in the world. Just start with military power. 21% of military spending in the world is European. About half is American. China accounts for 4%. And it's not just how much you spend, it's what you use. If you want somebody other than the United States to show up with troops in the world today, you call the Europeans. They've got 100,000 troops active in combat zones around the world. You often hear the statistic that the Chinese have the largest contribution to UN peacekeeping forces. The Chinese love to cite that statistics. That would be 2,150 troops, not 100,000. And in fact, the Europeans are now the only other major military force out there active in many parts of the world. But you might say military force really isn't what we need to deal with most problems in the world. What we need is civilian power. But Europe is, in fact, the preeminent civilian superpower in the world today. It's the world's largest trading power. It provides 70% of the world's foreign aid. It's the largest supporter of most international organizations and most international legal initiatives. The enlargement of the European Union is probably the single most influential and cost-effective tool for spreading peace and security that any country has employed since the end of the Cold War. And even though I'm not a big fan of European normative power, one has to note that when countries promulgate constitutions these days, it's mostly European-style things like international standards of human rights or parliamentary systems of government or restrictions on money and politics that they put into those constitutions, not American-style innovations. And when it comes to the domestic foundations of what it's going to take to be an effective country in global governance in the future, things like running your economy in a green way or having a high productivity economy, because I remind you, European economies are more productive than the American economy, or having effective health care, or educating four times as many foreign students as the United States. It's Europe that is the global leader as a civilian power. None of these things are going to change anytime soon. They're fundamentally grounded in the present, and they're going to remain this way for a generation or two because they're grounded in a high per capita income. And Europe is going to remain the other part of the world with a high per capita income, currently 10 times as high as China, for the foreseeable future. Nothing about the current crisis changes that. However, some people may say, yes, Europe has all these power resources, but they don't have the will to use it. They're introspective. They don't think like a global power. They think like a regional power. But that's not really the case. Europe is active throughout the world economically. They're certainly one of the great pillars of the global trading order. Now, you might say, well, the multilateral agenda is a little bit moribund, but there's a lot of activity going on a bilateral and plurilateral level with regard to NTBs, with regard to regulations. China is the largest trading partner of China, and it's very active on that front. It's the largest trading partner of every country in the Middle East. In financial area, even with problems in the eurozone, the euro is a quite influential currency, as you see from the reversal of Chinese policy in recent days in response to changes in the value of the euro. And as Dan Hamilton across the street never tires of pointing out, in the investment realm, it's Europe and the United States that still dominate the world economy. Europe, as was pointed out in the previous panel, is the dominant political, economic, and social interlocutor with Russia, which makes you a global power right there. And in crises like the Georgian crises, it's the Europeans with their stabilization force that are most active, the Europeans with their pipeline relations who can do something, and in fact the European Union with whatever energy policy it comes up with that really has the only chance of changing the dynamics of Europe's relationship with Russia. In the military realm, Europe is not just, as was suggested in the first panel today, a reactive country. Europe doesn't just land troops. It leads missions in places like Sierra Leone or in Lebanon. And I thought it was rather surprising in the first panel that Europe was criticized for being inconstant or reactive in places like Afghanistan. I think Afghanistan was the country where the United States wasn't really quite sure what its policy was for 8 years while Europeans were there holding the fort, fighting and dying. It was 40% of the casualties in Afghanistan the first 8 years of the war were non-American. A third of them were European. It's only in the last couple of years that the Americans decided what their policy was. I think that shows a rather stable and strong commitment on the part of the Europeans that should not be criticized. Europeans are active in Iraq, Africa, the Horn of Africa, throughout the world. Europeans are globally active in global warming. They're globally active in development policy, giving 70% of the world's aid. They're globally active in IOs. They lead policy in Morocco, in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Libya, in Lebanon. It is true, however, that Europe is prudent, that it tends more than the United States to focus on problems and issues where its policies are sustainable and incremental. And for that reason, it tends slightly more than the United States to engage in regional projects, projects in North Africa, projects in the former Soviet Union, projects like enlargement. But we might think of that as a good thing, as an attractive characteristic of policies. Europeans start policies and they finish them, unlike some other countries. And this is not to say that the projects they take on are easy. A project like European enlargement is extremely difficult politically. It is extremely difficult to sustain political support for that project in 27 countries. In some of those countries, support for enlargement can be measured in single digits in public opinion. This morning in the far corner, there was a colleague from the Heritage Foundation who gleefully questioned whether European integration, from the Margaret Thatcher Foundation, I believe, whether European integration could be continued in the face of referendum defeats and low public opinion support. Now, it's true, as Mark pointed out, that most of those referendum defeats had nothing to do with European integration at all. But to the extent that they did, it was mostly opposition to enlargement. And I think we should admire enlightened European leaders who are willing to pursue something like enlargement, even in the face of public opinion doubts. So Europeans are willing to pursue global policies with the global power that they have, even in the face of considerable political costs. Which brings us to the third and final point. Does the current crisis of the euro change any of this? Now, I've circulated on the front table a Newsweek piece that goes through some of the details of the crisis, and I agree with my colleagues about it, that this crisis is serious but not as serious as some think, and that Europe will do something more, it's likely to do something more than muddle through. I agree with Scheherazade, the point Scheherazade first made, that Greece probably did not belong in the eurozone at the start, but now will stay in it because it has to. But I don't believe that this was fundamentally a crisis of the euro. It was fundamentally a debt crisis. And there's a sense in which all debt crises are the same, whether they take place in Argentina or in Greece. They're crises in which the creditors want to get their money back and the debtors want to avoid being forced to adjust, and they have to come to some kind of a deal. France and Germany bailed out Greece, backed the euro with $750 billion, and permitted the ECB to purchase bad debt, not because they believe in European solidarity, not because they love Greeks, and not because they wanted to prop up the value of the euro, which in fact is a good thing for them that it's gone down to what Scheherazade rightly said is a more reasonable value. They did so to bail out their own banks and bondholders who were very highly leveraged, exposed in the Greek situation. And that is the way it always is in these crises, even if they take place in Latin America or in Asia or anywhere else. And in this sense, Europe is a community of interest. And it is this community of interest that is going to lead it to continue to deal with this crisis. So as my colleague said, they will exploit the breathing space to clear toxic assets out of their banking system, something they should have done some time ago when the United States and the UK and even China did so. Greece will default. Brussels will create more stringent and transparent banking regulations, default management, some kind of IMF-style oversight. Private lenders will reverse this fatal practice of lending to pigs at German rates. But the deeper lesson here is that that Europe often muddles through crises with European action as a last resort when national policies fail. And while old-fashioned federalists may dream of a United States of Europe, common fiscal policies, transfers at high levels to help people, in fact, European policy is often and often works best when it's cautious, piecemeal, and decentralized. We're not going to have economic governance at the European level to micromanage taxes and spending, but in the long term, it's likely, as in some of these other areas that I've mentioned, that Europe's response to the crisis may well be more innovative and effective than the U.S., China, and other global powers. That's why we shouldn't sell Europe short. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. The panelists have been very, very disciplined, and so they will be rewarded with extra questions before we move to the discussion with the floor. And I'd like to start with you, Lukas. Somehow, I'm the eternal optimist, and so a question on the Greek economy and the Greek political system. Somehow, couldn't this crisis be sort of good thing for Greece in the medium term, or probably even in the long term, in terms of bringing about from the outside a revolution in governance, etc., that could not be brought about by Greek politicians?
Well, as I said before, crises are very often the mother of change. The Greek system continued for long, a Greek system that, as I said before, had two important elements. One was clientelistic politics, which is the main explanation behind persistent fiscal deficits. And the other was a model of economic development which created a bubble, but more through the state sector rather than through private borrowing. Mm. So in that respect, the Greek bubble is different qualitatively from the bubble that the U.S. experienced, that the U.K. experienced, because it went through the public sector, not so much through the private sector.
Spain, right.
Mm. Now, having said that, if you want to be an optimist, and in my sort of, I always try to be an optimist as well, it is an opportunity for Greece to change dramatically, and this is now perceived by an increasing number of Greeks themselves. They have drawn a conclusion about what has been going on until now. I talked about a party that is clearly over. Now, we are changing. I mean, things, the kind of legislation that we have been introducing in the Greek parliament in recent months is more radical than anything that has happened in Greece in the last 10 or 15 years. In terms of pension reform, in terms of economic liberalization measures, in terms of budgetary cuts, and now there's more to come, in terms of administrative decentralization. All right? Mm-hmm. So there is evidence of real change. If you want to be pessimistic, you say that the task is simply enormous. And will the Greek political system and Greek society face up to it and be able to cope? Well, it remains to be seen. My test would be that if, let's say, one of the tests I would offer, and I offer it often to my compatriots, is that if after the next election in Greece, more than 30 or 40% of the existing members of the Greek parliament are still in parliament, then the change has failed.
Thanks. Let me stay on Greece, and I have a question both for you and for Shehrazade. The idea, so everybody seems to agree that there will be that no one will leave the eurozone because the cost would be too high. But a sort of intermediate proposition has been advanced by Ken Rogoff, and more importantly, in a long article by Marty Feldstein, the idea of a temporary leave of absence from the eurozone, the idea of a holiday from the eurozone where Greece would revert to the drachma for wages and prices, whereas basically bank balances and obligations would remain in euros. And so, of course, that would impose on the Greek population a sort of forced devaluation of their standards of living. And so how realistic do you think this proposition is? And I'll ask you the question, and then I'll ask Shehrazade
the question.
The
short answer to the question is this is a holiday in hell. And the Greeks are not masochist enough to indulge in that kind of holiday. It's as simple as that.
So you see basically an orderly restructuring of the Greek debt at some point when calmed down?
Like devaluations in times of fixed exchange rates, restructuring is not announced until it actually happens. Mm-hmm. Mm. Right? Now, I hope that Greece and others in Southern Europe will avoid restructuring. But if it does happen, I should hope that it does happen at a time when there is less panic in the markets. Mm. And this is the product of serious negotiation that involves all parties. Mm. And that kind of restructuring, I think we can live with.
Everybody treats restructuring as if it's some disaster. Countries restructure all the time. You know, restructuring is not the end of the world. You know, it's just, and after all, these creditors, you know, lent to Greeks, at the same rates as Germans. They should get 70% of their money.
Yeah,
back,
you have to make them reliable.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't just a bailout of Greece. It was a bailout of the banks,
yeah,
of the lenders.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so, as long as we don't make them reliable for the business models,
yeah,
it will just go on.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your piece the restructuring of debt of, in particular, of U.S. municipalities, I believe New York City among them,
yeah,
in the 1970s, right, and
yeah,
other models.
Yeah, in Latin America and so on, yeah. No, absolutely. It should happen.
Sure,
and it can happen in an orderly way, particularly if the EU prepares.
What do you think of the temporary leave of absence hypothesis and of the restructuring of the debt, and what do you see ahead?
Now, I agree with Lucas. This is not a viable option. The markets will pummel that country, and it won't be able to stand up if any of this ever comes to fruition. So I think everybody is fully aware of that. So not an option.
I have a follow-up question on the European banking system, because many voices have been heard saying that behind the – it was not just a question of bailing out French and German banks who had lent to Greece a lot, but it was also a more general question, a trigger for a more general questioning or skepticism about the health of the European banking system in general, given the fact that Europe had not done the stress test that America had done, or at least that it had done it privately and not publicly, thereby not sort of getting in a more healthy situation. How worried are you about the European banking system, and isn't that the next big question over the health of the...
And I think you're right. I think that, you know, this is the critical question here. You know, they will muddle through, but the question is, you know, they don't have time. They're hemorrhaging, and the markets act very, very quickly and very violently and very fast, and there is another shoe that's waiting to drop in Europe, and we haven't talked about it yet, and that is Central Eastern Europe. If you look at Greek banks, they hold almost 20% of the banking assets in Bulgaria, 15% in Romania, 10% in Serbia, and that's just the Greeks. Forget everyone else. And this is a trickle-down effect that's going to come. So in a crisis like this, whether it's right or wrong, whether you're bailing out the creditors, the bankers, and the investors, it's irrelevant. You have to stop the hemorrhaging, or everybody gets hurt. And I think we learned this in the U.S. crisis. So I think at this point, it has to be a very structurally reordering, as has been mentioned before. Institutional support, no waffling, none of the usual European nonsense about we do this, we won't do this, somebody speaks out. They have to speak with one voice in order to overcome this crisis, because this restructuring is coming down the road. It's coming for Greece, it's coming for Spain, it may even come for Italy.
Andy, how confident are you? So basically, European governments are now telling us, you know, the stability and growth pact, that was important, but, you know, we floated it a couple of times, but now we're serious. But, you know, since they did it before, how confident are you that the more stringent rules that you mentioned earlier will actually be respected by countries which remain sovereign about their economic issues?
I don't think there's going to be a real-time, constant stability and growth pact. I don't see any way to make that credible. So my view of it is that you can have credible controls on fiscal behavior of states in crisis situations. So that's what the IMF does. You can do it when you have leverage over them. So you're going to have to trust that the sense countries have they need to engage in domestic reform, and the punishment that bond markets are going to wield over them and surveillance is going to do it. If that doesn't do it, then Europe is in real trouble. But I don't see any way you can create a political mechanism that's going to these notions that you're going to, you know, take away countries' votes or, you know, limit their structural funds or something. I mean, I think that's just not serious. And I think it will go the same way as the structural fund thing. So I don't think that's serious.
Mm-hmm. Ralph, one question for you. You know, obviously this whole crisis is going to have an impact on other areas of European construction, if only as Mark was mentioning earlier this morning in the areas that you're particularly interested in international relations, in also in defense and spending for, you know, probably development aid, etc. How much of an impact do you think the specific Eurozone crisis will have, either through budgetary conduits or, you know, more generally for the confidence in the EU project and the I would say the enthusiasm of European leaders when they mm-hmm. come to other issues?
I'm afraid on the short and maybe the medium term, the European Union will become more inward looking in the sense of we will be very much busy with ourselves. And that the willingness and the ability to invest in global policies, both in political and in financial terms, will suffer from the current crisis. If you are listening to the public debates on budget restrictions, budget cuts, immediately it comes to the defense budgets, of course. And I think maybe there is a chance even in that, an opportunity even in that, if we can get rid of the irrationalities of 27 different defense budgets and 27 different military organizations, armies, and so on and so forth in Europe, and will come closer to a unified European army and a unified European arms regime. Okay, this could be a progress out of the crisis, but in most of the European countries, you have an absolute dominance of social policies and in general of domestic policies over international policies. This is different from the United States, where, as far as I can see, there's still this, it's almost the military spending almost independent from the economic developments in the country. This is not the case with Europe. Especially in Germany, our international policies are comparatively underfunded. That's not only the case with the military, it's the case also with our diplomacy and our foreign cultural policies and so on. So I think it will be more about focusing on the domestic problems and, of course, the willingness to enlarge the European Union, to include new members, already over the last years has declined. Because now we are confronted with an imminent conflict between deepening and consolidating the European Union and enlarging it. I'm very much in favor to keep to our promise that every European democracy can become member of the European Union. But that will mean that we have to rebuild the European Union and we have to come to a more differentiated system of European integration. But we will need a lot of political effort to keep this responsibility for countries outside of the European Union alive over the next years.
Good. We now have more than 20 minutes to go in a discussion altogether. So I'll take three questions in a row. Please identify yourself. And as Dan used to say, make sure there's a question mark at the end of your sentence. Sir, here, let's start with you.
Hi, my name is Anthony Odie. I'm a consultant here in Washington. At least three of the panel members seemed to agree that Greece is doomed to a restructuring. None of them was willing to say, okay, let's do it. Let's be decisive. Let's get it over with. Some wanted it to be orderly. Mr. Fuchs wanted to build new institutions. how will we know that the time has arrived when it's safe for the Greeks to default?
Thanks. I think another question in the back over there, the lady who's standing up.
Lots of.
Thanks.
My name is Contessa Bourbon from the New York Times. I'd like to get your comments on how worried are you on the plunging value of the euro currency, and to what extent does structural reform is needed to make euro survive?
Sorry, I didn't understand the first question.
How worried are you on the plunging value of the euro currency? Because it has been plunging for many weeks now.
Yeah. Okay. And Michael here in the front.
Michael Callingart from Brookings Council for the U.S. and Italy. I have a political question. Greece in the first instance, but really many other countries are facing and will face problems of adjustment politically. And others, governments need to have support ultimately for taking a lot of measures which are affecting population. I can certainly understand that intellectually or in a general sense there's recognition in Greece and others, countries, that things have to change. What I wonder about is perceived unfairness. In other words, a person saying, I'm being called upon to make such and such sacrifice, but other parts of society, other parts of the economy are not being treated equally. And how sanguine are you that that can be resolved?
Okay, so we have three questions. Who would like, Shehrazad, would you like to start on the value of the euro or any other question?
Sure, I think I mentioned this before. I think the value of the euro is actually okay. It had to readjust. 1.5, 1.4 something was way, way too high if you look at the European economic outlook, at least in the near term. So, and like I said, 1.2 is a very reasonable place for them to be, and some of us are actually surprised it's at 1.2, in fact, not lower. So I think that's one point that I would make. As far as the Greek restructuring. This is a very, very tricky game. You know, you're talking about an irrational market. The fear has to subside, and the timing has to be right. But until we do it, we're not going to know.
Lucas or Andy, do you want to?
Yeah. Andy, do you want to go first?
Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, we have witnessed a number of ups and downs of the exchange rate between the dollar and the euro. So this is not going to be the last one. I would agree with Scheherazade that 120 is probably a much better and more realistic exchange rate to have than the 150, almost 150 we had a short while ago. Number two, I wouldn't use the verb doomed to restructure.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I would again, and this was not concerted action in advance with Scheherazade, that this is not the time to do such a thing when panic prevails in markets. So it is true that both the bailout mechanism for Greece and also the European stabilization mechanism of 750 billion euros, which, if you think about it, if somebody told you 6 months ago that the countries of the Eurozone would agree to set up a European stabilization mechanism amounting to 750 billion euros, you would have thought that the interlocutor is completely out of his mind. Now, it has happened. It has happened simply because European governments reached the edge of the precipice and decided to react. And this is usually how European integration proceeds. So further integration is not the result of a conscious desire to integrate further. You integrate further because you have to preserve what you have already created. And because what you have already created creates enormous stakes for everybody involved, you're bound to react. And this has happened many times before, and it's likely to happen again. And this is precisely when I talked before, sort of in an indirect way, about Wall Street and City of London. This is precisely the mistake that people have been making time and time again. They constantly underestimate the commitment of Europeans to what they have actually built together. And they think that every time there is a crisis, the whole edifice is going to collapse. Well, it doesn't. I'm not suggesting that it will never collapse, because nobody knows. But let us not underestimate what has been invested in it. So if there is going to be restructuring, there has to be a better time, and it should be negotiated.
And it should be a joint decision involving the whole European Union. And if that happens, this is not the end of the world. And finally, fairness. The success of measures in Greece, at least, depends on two things. One is a perception among the population that the distribution of the burden is fair. And fairness is therefore directly linked to the effectiveness of measures that have been introduced to combat huge, widespread tax evasion. That's number one. And number two is it depends on the capacity, the ability of the government to convince people that even if the tunnel is long, there is light at the end of the tunnel. So you have to offer people and society a perspective. Because simply offering punishment and difficulty, well, Greeks, I'm sure many other people, this is true of many other people, but Greeks do not particularly enjoy pain. So if you do not enjoy pain, you have to offer austerity measures, but with something in the end. If you do not convince people about that, you have lost.
Yeah, exchange rate, purchasing power parity is 1.1. I think that'd be fine. On the that's what it's said to be. The key precondition, I think, besides expectations being in line, I mean, not panicking the market, the precondition is that the banking system be stable before you go for the restructuring. So I think you need to deal with the core European banks before you jump for the restructuring. So I would look to that as well. On fairness, I think, speaking as a political scientist here, that parliamentary systems in general are better equipped to deal with this than majoritarian presidential systems. If we had to deal with this problem in the United States, I think we'd be, you know, really in a fix. Generally, parliamentary systems have the attractive characteristics that they can be at once both decisive, because they aren't separation of powers systems, but they're also center-weighted, the way majoritarian systems like the American and the British system are not. However, and they are center-weighted because they tend to draw people toward the middle, toward coalitions, and so on. This raises, however, a problem because Italy stands out then as a problem country because it has, as Scheherazade pointed out, economic problems, and it, in an Italian flight of fancy, reformed its government, its electoral system again to move it in a more majoritarian direction, and has a rather polarized system. And I can't imagine any reforms in Italy being perceived by all of the population as fair. And that's going to create a difficult situation going forward. I don't know what Michael thinks about that, but...
Thanks. We're going to take three more questions. Andrew here.
Andrew here, Georgetown University. To Mr. Tsoulakalos, I'd like to ask, to what extent is Papandreou endangered politically or by what's been happening, or is this sort of enhanced his status at some point? I'd like to ask a similar question to Mr. Fuchs regarding Angela Merkel. How is she seen now in Germany, not to mention Europe as a whole? And if I may, to our moderator, Justin, or anybody else who'd like to respond, a general question. To what extent is the United States and, let's say, its mismanagement of its economic affairs for, over the years, but particularly the result of the crisis, Wall Street, subprime, and all that, to what extent is that now seen by European friends as really a rather negative dimension of how our contribution or lack of contribution to economic stability, and to what extent are Europeans aware of the fact that they really are were contributors to this global problem, or do they feel that in general the United States got them into a difficult situation?
Mm-hmm. Could you place the mic behind you to the lady in green?
Thank you. My name is Carolyn Poplin. I'm an attorney. This is not my specialty. My question is a follow-up on the gentleman over here who asked about social stability. Here, the crisis in Greece and the other countries is seen as a failure of the welfare state, and it will only be fixed when the welfare state is seriously cut back, and this is being used as an argument that we should cut back our much less supportive welfare state, reduce Social Security, reduce Medicare, reduce spending on education, that we need to go back to the 1920s. I'd be curious to know how it looks from you who are experts in this.
Okay, and third question, just the gentleman in front of you.
Jeff Stacey, the State Department, but I'd like to speak in a purely personal capacity as a former political scientist, mostly because once a geek, always a geek, but you get to ask more interesting questions.
Who are you calling a geek?
Not you, Andy. I mean, you were one of the people who, on this side of the Atlantic, one of the very few in the 70s and 80s who noticed that Europe was still on track.
You're that old.
that was
and,
him.
And so what I want to ask is about, you know, all the consternation and gnashing of teeth, the rising nationalism that you speak of, and I once made a bet in graduate school that within 20 years the euro would collapse because of optimum currency area theory and all these sort of things. The headlines, as you speak of, the motor of European integration is dead, the Germans are no longer good Europeans, all the rest of it spells terror in the short term. But in the long term, hasn't Europe been here before? And that long lost decade of the 70s, quietly, the EMS was built, and then boom, 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 five treaties in 20 years. And might suggest that Europeans have Americans to thank for the last one. We gave Iceland the flu, had a near-death experience, and the Irish decided they wanted to keep breathing and voted for the treaty. But is this not going to be a long period, as you suggest, but that the European phoenix will rise again, or is this thing really having a near-death experience?
Thanks. So we're going to have answers. Maybe, Ralph, you could start with Merkel. Is she threatened in any way?
No, without doubt, developments over the last 2 or 3 months, not only related to the European financial crisis, also to some domestic developments, undermined the image of the German Chancellor as an effective crisis manager and as an European leader. That's obviously the case. You can read it out of the polls. But at the same time, it's not just only a personal thing for the governing coalition, the liberal-conservative coalition in Germany. The fallout of the financial crisis finally turned the main political objective of that coalition into illusion, to reduce taxes. This now has gone, and this leaves this government in a quite uncomfortable situation, and they still didn't find a turnaround to a new political agenda, and the next weeks will be very controversial in Germany, because now it will come to the moment of truth, how the government wants to adjust the budget and which kind of budget cuts they will propose. So this will be a very conflictive period.
Sherazad, do you want to address?
Yes, I think that, you know, the social welfare state was raised, and it's clear that the Europeans have to increase competitiveness, whether it's through lowering prices or becoming low-wage competitors in certain southern countries. And I think the reality is this, that their social programs are going to have to be cut back almost permanently for some time to come. That doesn't mean they're going to look anything like us down the road, but the social welfare states are shrinking, And they have to do that. I think, look, I'll just tie this to something that Andy had said earlier about Europe being a superpower in all realms, economic, military, and so forth. Clearly, it is a superpower. But I think one has to recall something that 20, 30 years ago, European individual nation states were superpowers, Germany, France, the UK. And that has shifted. There is no question there has been a loss of power in Europe. Now, as united EU, this is the only way they can come and sit at the table. I don't think that any single European country can come and sit at the table with the United States or with China, for example. Just size matters here. The U.S. economy is, on any given day, a $14 trillion economy. Germany is $2.5 trillion. It's small, if you compare that. And, you know, military budgets, our military budget dwarfs anything the Europeans have done, if you look at dollar value. So I think this must be kept in mind.
Is it a strength or a weakness?
Both.
Andy and Lukas, do you want to answer? Maybe, Lukas, you could start. Papandreou, endangered?
No, I don't think Papandreou is in danger because he controls his party and there is no credible opposition for the very simple reason that the main opposition party is the one that has left him with the mess. So the opposition party is not a credible alternative and will not be a credible alternative for some time to come. Having said that, I think that Papandreou has limited time before he delivers. If he doesn't deliver, he will be in trouble. So he controls the situation, but time is short. That's the first reaction. The second is, luckily we have a welfare state in Europe. I can't imagine what would have been the situation if our welfare states had been much weaker during the time of crisis. But I agree that there's need for reform, not only because of the crisis, but also because of demography. So there's going to be a painful reform of the welfare system. And remember that for a large number of European countries, distribution of income inequality are crucial things in the political system. And also that a number of countries, not only mine, but also France and others, are what the French could call société contestatrice. So people get to the streets and demonstrate. So reforms are not always the easiest of things to introduce. And last point about Europe in the world, it is true that the relative weight of individual European countries, whether you measure it in terms of population, GDP, trade, has been declining steadily over the years and will continue to decline in the foreseeable future. And this is something that European countries are increasingly realizing, because this is not only a world that's becoming more multipolar, but the center of gravity is moving to Asia. So Europeans have realized that unless they operate as a unit, they will exert little influence in international affairs. But translating this realization into policy is never an easy thing. So that's why there's always a huge gap between European rhetoric and European delivery. We would like to do things, but we do not always succeed in doing them.
On the welfare state question, I think there will be some, certainly not an elimination or anything, but certainly some consolidation of the European welfare state. Just as we're going to have to make, every society has to make budgetary choices, we're going to have to make some here. Let's remember that you could fund all of Obama's proposed health care program out of what we spend on Iraq every year. So on the future of Europe, which might be a good place to end, you gave me a choice. Either the whole thing will collapse or the phoenix will rise and move on after the crisis to new and greater things. I think it's neither one, actually. I think that there is a kind of stable European constitutional settlement in place, that the status quo makes a lot of sense, and that there's going to be institutional innovation within the bounds of the current status quo, as we're seeing now. So people are going to work within the monetary policy area to improve things. People are going to work within areas, I think, like home affairs to improve things. But when it comes to opening up whole new areas for European regulation, like social policy or like taxing and spending or like education and culture, the things that are now national, I think they are not going to become international areas. I think they're going to remain national. So you're going to have a stable constitutional settlement at the European level where these things, which are actually the things of greatest concern to voters, social welfare, taxing and spending, education, cultural policy, and so on, even third country immigration, remain largely national. And the things we have now, market making policies, these kind of business regulation issues, trade, money and so on, some kind of international policing issues, some military issues, are international. I think that makes some functional sense. I think it makes some normative sense in democratic theory, if we could talk about that. I think it's politically stable. And I think it's an attractive vision. It's actually not unlike the kind of division of labor we have in the global multilateral system as well.
Sure.
And I think if Europe adjusted its rhetoric and self-presentation, its discourse, as the French would say, from a discourse of ever closer union, where it justifies itself only if it moves ever closer to total union, to a discourse where it says, we do these things in order to protect the right of Danes and the right of French and the right of Germans to do these other things themselves, it would be a much more legitimate operation.
Thanks. We have two minutes to conclude, so I'd like to ask the panelists for their concluding thoughts, and maybe starting with Scheherazade. One thing struck me, maybe we could conclude with this, is when you mentioned the sort of two-tier system inside the Eurozone of shaky countries and healthy countries. But more generally, isn't the risk that we're having for the 2010s, for the next decade, one of deflation, think Japan in the 1990s or even Europe in the 1930s, if we all cut our spending and restructure, et cetera, then no one will be left to buy things, and so we'll be in a deflationary spiral. Isn't that the deadly risk for the decade, and how much of a risk is it?
Yeah, I think this issue of lost decades is coming up for Europe, and I think it's much more a possibility in Europe than it is here. I think that this is all about growth, and I'm talking in terms of eking growth out. So, yes, I think there is a danger in Europe for this, but much less of a danger here. I think we'll restructure a little bit faster.
Okay. Ralph, very brief concluding remark.
Yeah. First, I would like to agree that Europe may be more stable as it is perceived in large parts of the United States because of the stability of its institutions and because of the still relatively good condition of its public infrastructure and its public services. And I think in a situation of crisis, public good matters. Public goods matter. And the second remark, we have been talking all the day, and especially in this last panel, on Europe. Is Europe the declining ex or a former power, or could Europe become maybe a model for other regions, global regions in the 21st century? I think we have to restart a transatlantic dialogue on these issues, not only on regulating the financial markets, where we urgently need to find common ground. If anything should happen, and if we will not miss the opportunity of the crisis, but also in terms of deficit spending and how to deal with exploding public debt. This is not only European, this is also an American, and it is a transatlantic issue, and if we don't have an intensive dialogue on that, there will be a rift. There will be quite political tensions between Europe, which is going more into the mode of financial adjustments and looking for balanced budgets, and the United States, which is increasing its public deficit and is still going along the path of deficit spending, so fighting debt with more debt. And these are really different political concepts and also and even different philosophies behind that, and we will have to have a serious dialogue on that.
Thanks. Lukas, one concluding thought?
I think we're going to have a more effective and closer coordination of national fiscal policies in the European Union, but the big question that remains to be answered is who and how sets the economic priorities. The crucial question, I think, for me in the next months and years is to generate growth in Europe. If we do not succeed in doing that, we are in deep trouble.
Yeah. Andy, one concluding thought? Okay, so that ends it. Thanks very much for being with us, and please join me in thanking the panelists for a great day.